This week, we pay tribute to George Abbey, one of the most elusive and controversial figures in NASA's history, who died on 24th March at the age of 91.
And to help us do this, we're joined by Michael Cassatt, who in 2018 released a book about Abbey called The Astronaut Maker, How One Mysterious Engineer Ran Human Spaceflight for a Generation.
Did you enjoy the eclipse earlier this week? We'd love to hear about it and how you viewed it. Let us know via our social media pages at Space and Things Podcast on Threads, Instagram, and Facebook, or via the contact form on our website.
And please consider joining us on patreon.com/spaceandthings. But right now, it's time for episode 189 of the Space and Things podcast.
Oh my God.
I'm Emily Carty.
And I'm Dave Charles. And welcome to episode 189 of the Space and Things podcast. How are you doing, Emily?
I'm doing good. I watched the partial eclipse because we did not get totality where I was, but saw the partial eclipse yesterday with my family. We had a great time. It was more of an excuse to just hang out and eat. But it was still, we had a wonderful time and we did get to see it, which was really cool. My eyeballs still hurt. I'm just kidding. I wore eclipse. We did wear the proper protective glasses so we could view it. So we had a good time watching it. So how are you doing, Dave?
I'm good, thanks. Yeah, I'm pretty good this week. Let's just quickly mention that eclipse, right? That obviously we didn't have it in the UK, but my internet feeds have been awash with images of how people watched it and some of their own views that they saw, which was very cool. But let's also just acknowledge that we have a bit of a problem with people sharing things on social media which clearly aren't right.
Yes, thank you. I was going to bring it up. Thank you for doing this. Thank you.
There's an image going around claiming to be taken by JWST, which is an infrared satellite, which is supposed to not be facing the sun. Like, they've done everything they can. They spent billions of dollars to make sure it's not pointing at the sun. Right.
Yeah.
So clearly it wasn't taken by JWST.
Yeah, it would burn up, right?
But people share it because it's a really beautiful image. But it's not an image, it's a piece of art which someone made a few years ago, right? So I think we all just need to take a second to just remember to be careful what we're sharing. Even if it looks amazing, just be careful what you're sharing.
Yeah, exactly. I saw that beginning yesterday, like right after the eclipse. And I'm thinking JWST, like if it took a picture of the sun, then there would be a press release like JWST exploded it. I don't know. There'd be a press release like, yo, we blew it up. It's over. We blew up this billions of dollar piece of equipment. Seriously, yeah, I was about to mention that. I'm so glad you did. Oh my God. I don't want to make people feel bad. But at the same time, just whenever you see an image, just be careful because there's so much AI out there and there's so much fake stuff out there. You just got to be careful nowadays with the internet.
Yeah. And to be clear, we're not having to go at people for sharing it. It's a lovely image, which is worthy of being shared for the power of the image. But acknowledge where it's coming from and what it actually is. Before you hit the share button, just think about things. Think about what you're sharing and where you're sharing it from. What page is that associated with? There are pages out there pretending to be organizations like NASA or public figures that are nothing to do with them. So it's just more of a warning. Everyone, just be aware of what you're sharing and where it's from. And if you want to share a nice image, share the nice image, but share it with the correct caption and where it's actually from. Don't get caught out because you might be enabling someone who shouldn't be enabled, if that makes sense. All we're saying is just be aware of what you're doing when you hit the share button.
Yeah, think about what you're looking at. Yeah, does this make sense? If it doesn't, then it likely is not what it says it is. So yeah, just be careful.
So let's crack on with this week's main feature before I get even more patronizing towards our listeners. Apologies if I've come across that way. Anyway, we mentioned this a couple of weeks back when it happened, but we really wanted to make sure we had the perfect guest lined up to talk about it, and now we've managed to do that. So today we're going to be talking about George Abbey, who unfortunately died at the age of 91 on the 24th of March this year. He started working at NASA in 1964 when he was still a US Air Force officer, and 3 years later he was a technical assistant to the Apollo spacecraft program manager, and he worked his way all the way up to the high echelons of management at NASA, becoming a center director before his career ended, spanning a number of decades. And he's been mentioned so many times on this podcast as a hugely influential and key player in a number of programs and aspects of spaceflight.
Yes. We've been saying for a couple of years now that we need to dedicate a whole episode to talk about him. And we're slightly embarrassed that it has taken his death for us to devote the time and the schedule to finally do this. So for someone who has come up so many times, we really should have done this earlier. Anyway, here we are. And to help us learn more about this, we're talking to Michael Cassatt, who released a book about Abbey in 2018 called The Astronaut Maker, How One Mysterious Engineer Ran Human Spaceflight for a Generation. Michael is also the co-author of Deke, the autobiography of astronaut Donald K. Deke Slayton, and we have captured the autobiography of astronaut Lieutenant General Thomas Stafford, and the author of three editions of Who's Who's in Space, 1987, 1993, and 1999, as well as five space-themed novels and 30 short stories published in Isaac Asimov's Science Fiction and elsewhere. He has contributed numerous articles to Air and Space Smithsonian and other publications, and has appeared as a space history expert in documentaries for the History Channel. As a television writer and producer, Cassatt has been a member of the writing team for a dozen different series, from The Twilight Zone to Max Headroom. Oh, wow. I used to love that show. He is currently co-executive producer of Sci-Fi Channel's series Z Nation, and is developing a drama titled Captain Cosmos with George R.R. Martin of Game of Thrones fame.
That's quite
wow.
It's quite the CV, isn't it?
That is quite the resume.
Yep.
Yeah.
Anyway, let's go and talk to Michael about George Abbey.
Greetings, Earthlings. We interrupt your regular programming to bring you an important message. It's time to crack on.
Hello, Michael. Thank you for joining us today on Space and Things. First, what inspired you to tackle the story of George W.S. Abbey, who was somewhat enigmatic and really behind the scenes?
Well, it was a combination of coercion and inspiration, because I had published the autobiography of Deke Slayton in 1994. And a gentleman you all know by the name of Tom Stafford had found it so engaging that at some point, through some mediary, a few years later, he got in touch with me and wanted me to not just do his life story, but actually fix a life story. He had an authorized biography written, and it did not work. And he thought I might be just the person to touch it up and fix it. I started looking at it and found out that it was unsalvageable. It was filled with mistakes, just didn't tell the story. So I just said, well, why don't I just do what I did for Deke, which is basically tell your life story. Thus launching myself on a very lengthy, fascinating, productive 3 or 4 years of working on Stafford's book. And in the course of it, I was someone who had looked at Abbey as this mysterious godfather-like figure in the space community, and probably had an opinion closer to what was on display in Dragonfly and in Mike Mullane's books, ultimately. But as I got to know Stafford and then got to see somewhat behind the curtain of NASA in the late 90s, I realized, no, there is a more complex story here. And I just happened to mention to Stafford at some point, I'd like to write Abbey's book. I mean, that's a book that needs to be written. It's sort of like the key to everything. And he took it on himself to convince George to do it, which took a little bit of doing even on my part. I remember having to sit down with him one evening in 2011 and sell him on the idea, and which I did.
Let's discuss Abbey's career at NASA. At the beginning of his spaceflight career, which began 60 years ago in 1964, he was an Apollo systems engineer. So how did he transition from that role to one more embedded in leadership and decision-making?
Well, The one thing you need to know about Abby, at least as expressed to me and confirmed by everybody else, is almost every big event in his life was something he didn't want to do or resisted. He did not want to go to the Naval Academy. Huh. He didn't want to be a helicopter pilot. And after he'd become an aerospace engineer, literally on the Dinosaur program as early as 1959, he did not want to go to NASA to work on the Apollo program in 1964. He had to be ordered by Sam Phillips directly to like report to Houston within 30 days. So what fueled his ascent was sort of like the ability to look at things coldly and analytically as an engineer, a pilot. He didn't think the Apollo systems engineering was particularly first rate or even third rate. He thought it was fifth rate when he got there. And so he just took it upon himself because that was his nature as well. I'm just going to fix this. He was the one who got in touch with the North American people and started saying, you know, you need to have a real specification for the spacecraft, which you don't have. And he just started all those steps that put him in a position to be sort of inevitable and invaluable. George Lowe, the revered head of the Apollo program after the Apollo fire, 1967, knew that Abby was just this kind of, I don't want to say ruthless because that implies something, just this incredibly capable, bright guy who would basically figure out what needed to get done and get it done. And he made him the executive assistant for the configuration control board that basically led the design and management of the Apollo program from about May 1967, 3 or 4 months after the fire, through the landing. And it was George's work on that panel, which is still a guide for anybody managing a major project, that put him in close contact with Gilruth, Lowe, and Kraft. And it was Gilruth who was still Robert Gilruth, who was still the head of the Space Center through the Apollo 11 landing, but planning to transition out over the next year or two at that point, who got together with Kraft, who was sort of his designated successor, and said, we need this guy in leadership.
Yeah.
And so they made him the, quote, technical assistant to the center director as of sort of the end of 1969. And there he was suddenly like the number three person on the what was then the Manned Spacecraft Center, now the Johnson Space Center, in charge of, I don't know, 10 to 15,000 people. He was suddenly there, having been an engineer like hundreds of other engineers.
Wow. That is awesome. Let's fast forward to the 1970s when NASA was fighting its frankly lousy track record in hiring women and people of color to its ranks. Now, Abby was one of the pioneers who insisted that 1978's astronaut group be more representative of what the U.S. actually looked like. So what motivated him as a stereotypically white male engineering type to really make this bold move at the time?
Well, yes, there was the stereotype, and I think it was truth that white males, especially white males, military caste, were not the most, you know, liberal, forward-thinking individuals in the country. Abby was actually rather an exception. He told me stories of having witnessed just flat-out racism. Back in the early 60s, he was in the Air Force, and he was relocated from the Dinosaur program office in Ohio back to his hometown of Seattle. And he had an associate who was actually outranked him, who had been a former Tuskegee Airman, a lieutenant colonel in the Air Force, who was black, and was helping him find housing. And when Abby said he would call people he knew, it was his community. Call around, says, this lieutenant colonel from who's a World War II pilot and an engineer on this program, looking for a place to live. Fine, send him over, bring him over. And every time he brought him over, somebody found an excuse to turn him away. And he said, you know, he had had experience as well with kind of his own, family's, racism going back to World War II, when his mother brought some Japanese students home for like a Thanksgiving dinner. And he was just far more sensitive to it because he had seen it enough, and he was wildly empathetic about the lack of opportunities. And also, as sort of the first line of contact for the NASA leadership in Houston, I mean, all the letters that went to Gilruth, all the letters that went to Chris Kraft, who became the center director in 1972, there'd always be letters from young women or members of minority groups about joining the space program. And Abby had to answer them all. He was the one who answered them.
Hmm.
And so he was just aware that there was this lack in society, lack in the space program itself. And he just thought it was wrong. And so he was going to make sure it changed. Now, to be fair to Chris Kraft actually who had put Abby in charge of selection as of 1976, said, we need to do this. Certainly he agreed with Abby. He hurried it along, whereas say Deke Slayton, my old buddy, who had been one of the Mercury astronauts and in charge of this for years, was not enlightened on this subject and had walked out of the first meeting where the idea of reaching out to historically black colleges, to women's groups and things like that to try to find future astronauts, a more diverse cast. He wanted nothing to do with it. But Abby persisted and made it happen.
Wow. So during the 1980s, I'm fast forwarding a bit again, Abby was responsible for many of the iconic shuttle mission crew lineups, just as Deke Slayton, another space giant who you've worked with, assembled the great Apollo crews. So what do you think, I hope I worded this okay, what do you think was the secret sauce regarding Abby's process of putting these diverse groups of astronauts together on missions?
Well, people would always look at that process and think it was mysterious or alchemy or witchcraft. Even the astronauts inside the office wondered, like, how and why does this happen? It would seize on any rumor or any hint. Well, Abby, you know, was talking to somebody who was your simulation instructor. So, God, if you screwed up that day or you were slow on something, you're dead. You're out of the loop and things like that. Or if you were a Navy pilot, you were good. Didn't matter what, even though Abby had been an Air Force pilot. Mostly it was simply this is you look at the requirements for a mission. I mean, he walked me through this innumerable times, and I'm not the first person he's talked to about it. I mean, you know, you could get him to talk about it. He said, you have a pool of people, you have a set of missions with certain kinds of requirements. So you look at the people and you just simply seem to try to match them to the task. Overlaying all of this, though, was an idea that Abby, who could be quite paternalistic, was thinking about people's lives and careers as well. So there were oftentimes he wanted to make sure someone got some experience in a sort of a secondary role so that two missions down the line or another mission down the line, the individual would be in a position to lead it. He also, obviously, because he would take his time and socialize with people and just listen to everybody about everything, which is either, you know, brilliant intelligence gathering or stalking, but or somewhere in between or some combination of it. He had a sense of, for example, who got along with whom, you know, who wanted to work with somebody else, who was actually way ahead of everybody else in certain like remote manipulator arm training and things like that, or just who was a good leader. And so he would factor all this, run that through the Abby brain computer, knowing that he wanted a mix of people. You wanted an experienced pilot as the commander. You could have a rookie pilot as the shuttle pilot. If you had the two or three mission specialists, well, you would always want someone who had experience, flight experience, to basically babysit and lead the one or two rookies on the crew in just the whole experience. And so it was that. I mean, there would be the occasional external drives. I mean, he knew he wanted a woman astronaut on the first available shuttle crew, which was STS-7, the first one that was after the orbital flight test, something that where he was going to start bringing the new people in. Everybody knew and assumed, and it was Kraft and NASA leadership as well, there was going to be a woman on that crew. There was going to be a black astronaut on the next crew. There were just external pressures to make sure that the new representation in the astronaut office was represented in flight crews. But aside from that, it was who did he think would do the best job at the best time with an appropriately mixed group of people around him or her.
Which kind of leads on to the next question. You've mentioned Mike Mullane's book a couple of times in which he's very critical of Abby. And
yes,
obviously there's other examples of people who are quite critical of him as well. How do you think this period of his career will eventually be portrayed in history. Do you think that he's perhaps misunderstood even by those who criticize him, or do you think that their criticisms have some validity as well?
Well, Mullane, in the obvious source for the Dragonfly book, which is equally as critical, at least in one chapter, and no obvious source of that was Norman Faggard. There were, again, it just sort of goes to the nature of organizations and the nature of evolving organizations. Mullane, who had a lot of criticism of Abbey, many of them justified, if I think mistaken. I mean, he didn't like the fact that the training was, there weren't specific gates, there weren't grades, there weren't standings. You didn't know where you stood because that's how they had done it in the Air Force. And that's understandable. But what he, in that particular instance, didn't understand is that Abbey and Kraft and John Young were also trying to figure it out themselves. Yeah. This process of training and evaluating people in 1978, 79, 80 was still evolving. NASA as an organization did not know how to deal with, you know, civilian scientists as, you know, mission specialists and people of color and women. They were still learning how to do it, and also to train on the very complex system that was the space shuttle, how to deploy people, how to put them in the loop of brakes and tires and thermal systems and then EVA and guidance and navigation. It was all still evolving. It has evolved. I mean, the whole space station process, for example, has evolved wildly over 25 or 30 years and is far more transparent in the sense that same like Mullane or Norman Thagard would probably have wanted and desired in those days. But it was just still evolving. So some of the things that some of Abbey's critics complained about were actually Chris Kraft orders or ideas as well. A lot of them were things that were a little out of Abbey's control. And he himself, just by his nature, there was a sense that you give people a little rope, you let them go, you find out what they can do. So he was not big on guidance. He was more big on giving someone a goal or a mission and seeing what they did. Now, that can end several ways. You know, you can have someone who goes out, like there's a question. It isn't even a question of asking, you know, waiting for a specific answer. It's like you just want somebody to come back with an answer. There's the famous case of the Autoland capability. One astronaut was tasked with, you know, go out and find out why we can't do Autoland with the shuttle. And the young astronaut went out and came back and said, actually, we can do Autoland with the shuttle and it'll be very easy. And the feeling, you know, within the office was that in particular George Young, like he was dead for having come back with that. And maybe with John Young, who was actually also more of an issue in a lot of the things astronauts complained about than Abbey. But Abbey didn't necessarily think that was the wrong answer. It was the fact that there was an answer and that this young astronaut had gone out and beat down the system and found out something that needed to be found out was valuable. Also told Abbey that, you know, here you have an individual who is going to go out and do what needs to be done too. So that also was something that factored into crew assignments and leadership roles. It's like, well, who would just go out and kind of take the hill in spite of all obstacles, as opposed to wandering around either complaining about it or failing to do it or coming back with something that was the answer you thought the boss wanted. That isn't necessarily what Abbey was looking for at times.
So when you were talking to him, obviously after Challenger, he kind of got, I suppose he got moved on, didn't he, from Houston to DC?
There's no doubt. He was kicked to the curb.
Did he feel that was unfair, or did he understand why that happened and why it needed to happen, perhaps?
I don't know how long he would have, without the Challenger, I don't know how long he would have wanted to stay in that job. I mean, he loved it, but I suspect, you know, if he went two or three years beyond 1986, he would have found someone would have come to him with something else and moved him somewhere. If nothing else, up to, you know, be center director or something like that, which he ultimately became anyway. He had very conflicting views on Challenger and recovery. The Challenger accident, of course, is personally devastating to him. I mean, the most emotional parts of the book and my conversations with him were just talking about, first of all, him running around that morning trying to find Rocco Patrone and other people, getting them on the phone to find out what was going on, because he had just dropped the the crew at the last step before they went to the pad, and he could see there was ice all over it. He didn't think this made any sense to be flying that day, and yet he had everybody up and down the system saying, well, everyone says it's okay. He was basically 30 seconds off the phone when they launched, and he still did not think he had heard anybody definitively say why this is a good idea. And then he's the one who has to pick up the pieces.
Yeah.
He's the one who had to like get the families. He had to, you know, and he got a lot of criticism for, you know, waiting for President Bush to come and address them. Whereas like half the people themselves, everybody around there wanted the president to come and, you know, comfort people because they were devastated. And also it was taking time. No one had done this before. You've got all these families who have luggage at, you know, hotels and motels in Cocoa Beach. Somebody's got to gather this stuff. I've got to get an airplane. I've got to get these people out of here. They get out of there about as soon as it could be. He sat with, and Mike Smith on the crew was probably, along with Al Onizuka, was probably his closest friend in the astronaut office. Mm-hmm. And he said, I sat there with Jane Smith with like their three-year-old daughter on my lap on the flight back. And we were all just completely devastated. So, and then recovery of the bodies, you know, all this stuff actually fell to him to be responsible for. And it was emotionally devastating. His family was desperately worried about him. They thought he was clinically depressed. They wanted him to get help, get counseling, and, you know, go through the hearings where they find out, you know, what really went wrong and what were we going to do to fix it. I mean, just that process alone was devastating to anybody, and especially to him, because he was sensitive and he had lost friends and he felt responsible. All this had taken place on a leadership vacuum. NASA had a temporary or an acting administrator who'd been on the job for like 10 days. There was no leadership at the Johnson Space Center. There was an acting administrator or somebody who'd just been appointed. So Abby knew that new people were going to be coming in. And he assumed that new people would be making their changes. And it turned out one of them was Dick Truly, who wound up becoming an atmosphere and very much what you used to call a friend of George, somebody that Abby had hung around with and was really quite close to, and vice versa. I talked to Dick Truly extensively about Abby, and he was fascinatingly helpful and honest about it. He loved George. He thought, you know, he had all these great skills. You know, yes, could be more secretive than you'd like, but, you know, ultimately he was great at his job. But he said, I was the new head of human spaceflight in Washington. We needed a new center director, and the new center director needed to have his own people in place, his own direct reports. So when the new center director came in, Abby knew was not going to be, he was not going to be long for this earth, because it's somebody he did not particularly get along with. And so he just knew it was inevitable that he was going to be moved.
Yeah.
So those reading The Astronaut Maker, which is your biography of George Abbey, might be surprised to learn that Abbey and the late General Thomas Stafford were figures behind essentially saving what would become the International Space Station. So how did Abbey and Stafford have such a long-range vision into the future when their roots were really in the Gemini and Apollo eras and even earlier?
Stafford and Abbey and the space station, and throw Golden in there, obviously. Dan Golden, the new administrator, or coming in summer 1992. The thing is they weren't actually looking back. I mean, Abby, sitting down with Abby over a glass of Merlot, which I did many times, you could, you know, hear more about Apollo than anybody should ever need to hear. And Stafford was not shy about referencing his own history with anything, especially if it involved a Stafford triumph. But they were forward-looking. They saw a bigger picture of the human spaceflight universe as NASA had it, and they knew there was no way forward from space station freedom, the 1984 concept and start that was floundering and over budget and shrinking and lacking political support by 1992. They just realized this was going to have to be an international project. It should have been from the beginning, and we're going to go out and we're going to make it happen. And this was very much a case of corners may have been cut and, you know, books may have been cooked to make it happen, but they did make it happen. I mean, it's still up there. And this is, you know, we're 30 years past that process, much less, 20, 25, going in 26 years after the first launch. And I think you would say it was a success. And I will make the case to anyone, forget the shuttle cruise, which is, I think, something people will look at positively because the crews were actually pretty good. But you look at the space station, there's no space station without Stafford and Abby. And I would say even more Abby than Stafford. Stafford sort of played the Hyde game. He played the international role. You know, he was the face of Apollo Soyuz, and the Russians revered him then and even, you know, beyond death. But he would turn the nitty gritty, the find me the tools, turn that over to Abby. And Abby was by then the person who knew it. It's a quote I think I put in the book. It comes from F. Scott Fitzgerald in his unfinished last novel, The Last Tycoon, about the movie studio head who was his role model for a character, that he had the entire equation of pictures in his head. Abby by then had the entire equation of human spaceflight in his head. He knew more about it from every level than anybody walking. And so he knew kind of where to push, where to prod, what questions to ask, who to turn to, where the work would need to be done. And they convinced Golden, who didn't actually need much convincing because he could see the same things. He could see that Space Station Freedom wasn't going anywhere. And NASA lacking a space station would not have a human spaceflight program within a few years because the space shuttle would be too expensive and people would start asking questions, what are we using this to launch satellites for? And it would have withered. I think I made the argument that without the International Space Station program, there would have been no human spaceflight in the 21st century.
Wow, yeah.
Because Russia was never going to be able to afford it through the 1990s. They would have been out of the business by 1995 without U.S. subsidies. I doubt China would have started if the United States and Russia weren't doing it. I mean, maybe they would have gotten around to it eventually, but I don't think they would have started it then. And NASA would have been out of it by the year 2000.
Yeah, crazy.
So yeah, they were key in pushing on the political front and the technical designs and, you know, what is the model of the vehicle we're shaping? You know, what modules come from where? How do they, you know, how do we launch them? Moving it to an inclination that the Russians could reach. I mean, all those things were decisions that Golden, Stafford, and Abby made.
Do you think anyone alive now in the space program, obviously the space program is a lot different. We have government and commercial entities, have a career as influential and widely ranging as Abby's? And what do you think is his legacy?
I'm sure there are people walking around right now in both SpaceX and NASA, not Boeing apparently, who are as smart and experienced as Abby and have the potential. I don't think either system, well, certainly the NASA system is not allowed for someone like Abby to rise from where he started to be what he became. SpaceX is probably different. It's, you know, a leaner, meaner organization, more agile, as it ought to be, because it's a commercial entity that basically comes along two generations into the history of human spaceflight. And there are other companies as well, I think, that will come along. Although I don't know anybody's going to have the launch history that SpaceX has. I don't know that it's either going to be possible or necessary, but there it is. So I don't know that it's possible for anybody to go from reluctant engineering detailee to the Apollo program to head of the Space Center, having already been sort of in NASA leadership in Washington. Abby, by the way, did not want to go back to Johnson in the 90s. Stafford was on vacation somewhere in Bali or somewhere in the Far East, and Golden had to call him 2 a.m. Stafford's time, wherever he was, and tell him there was a national emergency, that Golden had been trying to get Abby to go back to Houston in late 1993, early 1994 to run the space station program that had just been approved, the new International Space Station. And it was Stafford who called Abby and, you know, did the old, you know, you need to do it for your country speech on him to get him to do it. So I don't know that that is possible anymore. That, first of all, you have these two or three individuals kind of playing musical chairs, space station heroes, manipulators, leaders, whatever you want to call them, the authority is too burdened. There are people out there who are as smart. I don't know that they're in a position and that the lanes are open for them.
Absolutely. So just to finish off then, the second part of Emily's question there was, what do you think is his legacy? How do you think he'll ultimately be remembered?
Well, there are a couple of levels to that. I think based on some of the publications that we had had, this kind of goes back to, I'd said I had to convince Abby to let me tell his story. The conversation basically went like this, and I will shamelessly admit that it was somewhat alcohol fueled. Sitting at the Villa Capri, where George, you know, for the last 25 years of his life, basically had dinner and drinks four or five nights a week, well into perhaps the second bottle of Merlot, George, Abby saying to me, "Why should I let you tell this story or do my life story?" And I said, "Because based on what has been published so far, you're going to be blistered by history. So I'm the only hope you have to tell your side of the story."
Mm.
And I feel pretty good about what I was able to do in terms of at least telling a fuller view. I mean, I don't want to, you know, Mike Mullane's book is fantastically entertaining and funny. And it is his story in Dragonfly is a fascinating story, the Brian Burrow thing. He obviously got information from people he would not have expected. And by the way, Abby had encouraged people to talk to Burrow. That's the other thing. It's like Abby comes out bad in it, but Abby had authored this guy. He's a good writer. Let the chips fall.
Wow.
And some of them fell. Did back to Mullane. I don't want it. I'm using him because he's the poster child for, you know, the Abby critic in public and in print. Where you stand often depends on where you sit. You know, if you were a rookie astronaut in the shuttle program early days, you were probably wondering what the hell was going on and not liking a lot of what you saw. In the same sense that in any organization, you're not that happy with the boss, especially the bosses seem to be giving goodies to other people, not you.
Yeah.
But beyond that, I think he now will be and should be seen as the key player in not only Apollo at a certain level, but obviously shuttle and human spaceflight, and especially the space station. Not even the shuttle's probably almost like third on the list. He was just simply someone who had the vision, who had the intelligence, and had developed the tools to make the system work, which is a skill that is just not common in any walk of life.
All right.
Absolutely. Well, thank you very much for joining us and for spending some time with us today to talk about Abby. It's something we've been meaning to do for a very long time. So I really appreciate getting this insight. And the book is wonderful as well. It's one of my favorites to reference when you're talking about him, because his name comes up so often, as it should do, when we've been talking about such a variety of subjects. Emily, you remember we spoke recently to an English, Welsh man, sorry, he will not like me saying it, calling him English, a British man.
And Abby particularly not like that.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, absolutely. A British man who has set up who's a teacher who now runs astronaut talks, and it all started because he met Abby in a pub in Wales, which is crazy. You know, his name comes up so often as being an important part of the story of what happened, and also the bigger picture of reaching out to people. And I think that's really important that we've given him some time to have this conversation. So thank you very much for joining us.
Yes, thank you.
Yeah, hopefully we'll speak to you again sometime.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Coming at you faster than Skylab falling down on Australia. This is the Space and Things podcast.
You and I have mentioned Mike Mullane's book as being amazing so many times, and it's obviously got mentioned there as kind of caused controversy around George Abbey's place in the history of the shuttle. And I still love Mike Mullane's book.
Yeah, same here. I think it's a great book.
And I think some of the criticisms in there are justified. And as Michael said there, from the point of view he's coming from, you can see why he's made them. But I think getting that well-rounded vision of who George Abbey was, what he did and why he was important is really important. And if you haven't read The Astronaut Maker, I really do urge you to read it. There's a good audiobook version as well that I would recommend. Find out more about this guy. The more you find out about him, the more amazing it is. It's like there are two Georges in my head, which I think, and we've covered the other one, that I feel like everyone needs to know about when they're learning about the history of American human spaceflight, and that's George Lowe and George Abbey. Those two people cover such a huge expanse of what happened and how it happened. And if you're interested in behind the scenes, they're the people you need to know what made them tick and how they operated and why they were so effective. And you can transfer those skills into many other industries and other situations.
Oh, yeah.
So personally, I'm really glad we've spent some time talking to Michael about that book and about Abbey, because I think it's a really important story that people need to know.
Absolutely. And if you haven't read them yet, go get Deke. Go get that book. Go get We Have Capture.
We Have Capture.
Yeah. And go get The Astronaut Maker, because I feel like you almost have to read all three of them. It's sort of like Michael Cassatt's NASA leadership trilogy, I would say, because it's three great NASA leaders. They're very different people. They probably didn't all agree with each other at the same time on similar issues, but I feel like you almost have to read all three of them, you know, to sort of get some insight into some of the great NASA leaders in the agency's history. And The Astronaut Maker is one of my favorite books. I'm glad he did it. I'm glad Abbey agreed to do it, because like Cassatt said, you know, if that hadn't come out, it would have just been Dragonfly and other books. And Dragonfly is also an enjoyable book. I'm not passing judgment on Mulane's book or Dragonfly. They're good books. They're very well researched. I don't have an issue with either of them, but The Astronaut Maker kind of provides a little more context, I think, a little more historical context and a little more, okay, this is how I saw it versus maybe how others saw it. You know, this is from my viewpoint. I think it was brilliantly done. I honestly, before I read it, I was on the same sort of like, man, you know, I don't know if I even care for this person, and I hate admitting that, but once I read it, I was like, okay, I understand why he did that. I get it now. You know, I get this. And I honestly came out of that reading that book with a lot of respect for George Abbey, because I loved how he was really one of the people behind, okay, we got to hire people who actually look like the country. He was actually kind of a transitional civil rights kind of a hero in NASA's history, because at the time when the 1978 astronauts were being hired, or being at least examined to be hired, NASA's track record for diversity was terrible. I mean, it really was. It was so bad it had made it to like the newspapers. Yeah. Like, that's how bad it was. I mean, really, it was, they did not have a good track record on hiring people of color or women or anything like that. Obviously, the 70s were a big time when, you know, women's rights were becoming a huge watershed thing. Civil rights was obviously a big deal, and you know, something had to give. And I think Abbey was really one of the figures who was like, okay, we really got to do something about this, because this is a problem. Who's the most public facing part of NASA? The astronauts, right? Everybody, you know, they're the big celebrities. We got to have them look like America. When I came out of that, reading that, I was like, that's really cool that he did that. If that's the only thing he was remembered for, and he'll be remembered for a lot more, but if that was the only thing he was remembered for, that's spectacular. That is a moon landing, in my opinion. I really came out of that book with a new respect for him and a new appreciation for what he did and some of the suffering he went through. Like Michael said, the Challenger, that was very devastating to him psychologically. And I don't think people really appreciated it. They see, you see sort of a person surface, right? And they look calm and collected and kind of cold, but you don't see what's going on. So yeah. I came out of that book with a different appreciation for Mr. Abbey.
I think it's important that we acknowledge, and we have done with other characters as well that exist in this history that we love so much, that people are complex and no one's perfect. And what to one person is a mistake, to another person is the right thing to do. So having different sides of the story presented is often really important and will ultimately help us get the more rounded version of history. And we can therefore make our own decisions on whether they're a good or bad person within that history. And
yeah.
And ultimately everyone involved is probably a little bit of both. The key thing with Abby, as I said earlier, also with someone like George Lowe as well, is ultimately they're really good examples of what management can be and can achieve. We often look at the key players in terms of the astronauts, but that isn't the whole story. The astronauts didn't make these programs run. They were the front and the face of them. And without Abby, without Lowe, without Gilroof, who's probably another person we need to do an episode of.
Yes.
Without those people and their vision, you don't have a space program. You don't have a successful Apollo program.
Yeah.
As you said, you don't end up with diversity coming in involved, getting involved in by the shuttle period and so on and so forth. So I think you have to look at these people and you have to, if you're really interested, I mean, it's the next level down, isn't it? Some people like dinosaurs. I like going to the National History Museum. It's great to see the dinosaurs. I haven't got a clue about the different periods that they're from. I just like going along and seeing the dinosaurs stuff, right?
Yeah.
And that's,
I don't know about the dinosaur leaders. Yeah, like, who's the head dinosaur?
There's levels of knowledge.
Who's controlling the dinosaurs?
There's levels of knowledge you actually need, isn't there?
Yeah,
And for maybe some people think, oh, I don't really need to know how NASA was run or how those decisions were made. But some people like to know that extra level. And if you want to know the next level of what made the Apollo program work, what made the space shuttle work, what made what makes the ISS be what it is today, you have to look at those people.
The next layer of skin, I guess.
Yes, that's exactly
because you have the top layer and then you have the layer underneath that's kind of supporting everything.
Yeah.
Okay, what's going on with that? Is that, I don't know.
So anyway, thank you, Michael, for joining us there. And I hope people have learned something. But yeah, definitely go and check out those three books, as Emily said. And also check out Dragonfly and Mike Mullane's book as well. They're good books. It's interesting.
They're not
reads.
Bad books. They're good books. I love Mullane's book a lot. I think it's a fantastic book. I like Dragonfly a lot, but they are different. I'm just saying they are different takes on this story. So they're coming from a different perspective, I should say. They're not different, but they're coming from a different side. So I think it almost behooves people to see each layer of the story. So yeah.
Absolutely. So of course, check out the show notes for more information about Michael and also those books.
Please leave us a review or share our podcast with your spaceflight loving friends. This is Space and Things Podcast.
So Emily, what has caught your eye in spaceflight this week?
It just happened like literally 5 minutes ago. The final Delta IV heavy launch, NROL-70, has lifted off. I am looking at the Florida Today article. I am not looking at the live feed right now, only because we are taping this podcast as this is happening, and I don't want to get too distracted. I don't want Dave to be like, Emily, you all right? So I'm not watching the live feed, but according to Florida Today, just a few minutes ago, ULA released this tweet: three main engines up and running and liftoff of NROL-70 mission for the National Reconnaissance Office. They don't exist, so don't pretend I didn't say that. As the Delta IV Heavy clears the tower for the final time. So this is the final Delta, I believe it's a final Delta launch of all time. This is it. We couldn't see it from here today, unfortunately, because there's quite a bit of cloud cover in St. Petersburg where I'm at today. But I'm very sad because I'm like, it's over. And I did get to see a few of those launches. If you missed this launch today, you can always go to ULA's channel. They'll probably have a lot of replays up later today if you would like to watch it. And also they have a lot of other Delta variant launches on YouTube as well. You could probably just type in Delta Rocket on YouTube and get tons of videos if you really want to go replay that stuff. An era is really over today, which is kind of weird. I do want to mention that ULA's Vulcan rocket, which successfully launched on its debut launch in January, is basically going to take over the missions that the Delta IV Heavy and other variants did. It's a very versatile rocket. I believe it's a heavy lift. And obviously in January, its first debut launch went really almost unbelievably successfully. So that's basically just happened just now. It is Tuesday the 9th. So yeah, that's really what I've got for this week. I'm kind of sad and feeling nostalgic, but like I said, I've seen that rocket a few times and I got to experience a few launches myself, and I'm very grateful for that. So goodbye Delta IV Heavy and hello Vulcan. Dave, what has caught your eye this week?
Well, two things. First of all, both of which I've got articles about, which will be in the show notes as always, as well as we'll put the video of the final Delta IV Heavy launch as well. So check that out on spaceandthingspodcast.com or click the link in the description of this podcast. But my two things that I will be putting in the show notes myself is that NASA has picked three companies to design the lunar rover for Artemis astronauts to drive on the moon. This is the next phase of wow. development for these moon rovers. And we have Intuitive Machines, which have a Moon Racer rover, which is looks pretty cool.
Yep.
We've got Astrolabs and Lunar Outpost as well. So all three of those. And some of the images of these vehicles look amazing and very exciting. So futuristic. Certainly an upgrade from the lunar rover that we so fondly think about from 1971 and 72. So, yes, that's a quite exciting story to go and have a look at and find out about the next phase to see. So, essentially, each team will continue to develop its rover over the next 12 months.
12 months?
Yep, under a feasibility task order.
Okay.
That aim is to get one of these on the Artemis 5 mission, which is currently scheduled okay. for launch in March 2030. So still quite a way away here.
I'll be 52, yeah.
Perfect.
I'll be 52 by then.
Drive around on the moon. Fly me to the moon. Drive around the moon.
Yeah. Hopefully I won't have a walker by this point because, man, my knees are hurting.
I'm just looking forward to how this is all going to go down in popular culture. You know, you think of all the songs, all the great songs that came out about going to the moon in back in the day, you know, Rocket Man and Life on Mars, so on and so forth. All the big artists were singing about going to the moon. But driving around on the moon, that's got to be something, isn't it? You know, you've got so many great, you know, country music loves a song about a truck. So there's going to be some great country songs about trucks on the moon. I really hope so.
A whole new Beyonce album.
Yeah, I'm looking forward to the moon being a highway reference. Anyway, the other thing that's caught my eye is that Blue Origin have announced a crew for NS-25, their next suborbital flight. And it's going to include Ed Dwight, who was the first ever black astronaut candidate who never flew back then and never actually made it to be an astronaut. But this is long overdue.
Yeah, I won't get into too much of the story because it is very, it makes me angry. But basically, he was set up to be the first black astronaut candidate and he was trying to become a test pilot. He experienced a lot of, to be frank, racism in that regard, and he never quite made it. Recently, a great documentary came out, I think in February, on Nat Geo, which discussed this. I think it was called The Space Race, and it had a lot of stories of black astronauts in it, including Charlie Baldwin, Ron McNair, probably Robert Lawrence as well. All those amazing pioneers. But now he's finally going to space. I feel like a wrong has been kind of reversed in a way. That is wonderful. That is wonderful. And I can't wait to watch it. It's going to be fun to watch.
Yeah, looking forward to that. We haven't got a date yet. So keep an eye out for that. And when we know more, we'll probably, I say in the run up to it, Emily, why don't we do an Ed Dwight episode? I think that would be, it's long overdue as well.
Yes.
So let's do that.
Yep, we need to do that.
This podcast relies on the generosity of our members. To help out, you can sign up at patreon.com/spaceandthings.
So thank you for joining us this week. We would love to know more about where and how you listen to our podcast. I get a weekly email telling me where we've been in various Apple podcast download charts, which is quite fun. And we've been riding high this week in Belgium and Norway. And I've got no idea who is listening to our podcast in Belgium or Norway. So if it's you, please do get in touch or leave us a review. Everyone, just go and leave a review, but don't say what you think of the podcast. Just tell us what country you're in and where you're listening and what device. What do you do when you're listening? Are you driving? Are you going for a walk? Are you walking the dog? Let us know, because I'm fascinated by how people listen to our podcast. So go, if you're an Apple Podcast listener, just go onto Apple Podcasts and put it in reviews. I listen to this in this country whilst I'm cooking my dinner, for example. Just let us know.
Yeah, I do find it fascinating. And hello to everybody who listens to us in Belgium and Norway. I think that's awesome. And also, thanks for all those who share the podcast with your friends and family, too. It really does help us out. We'll be back with more Space and Things next week. But until then, don't forget, in space, no one can cure you, me.
Thank you for listening. New episodes every Thursday. This has been the Space and Things podcast.